This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We should move on to the final speaker. Thanks, Phil, for your patience. Dr. Phil Rosenthal is a really distinguished head of the Transplant Hepatology Group and really has a very impressive record of running all these NIH-funded clinical trial. So he's going to talk about the epidemic of pediatric fatty liver disease. Phil, thanks. Great. Okay.
Thanks, Francis. So I'm the only person that's keeping you from the possibility of developing ASH. So I will therefore try to go as quickly as I can. But I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about NASH. And though I don't have exciting numbers to show you, I will remind you that NASH is the most commonly found liver disorder that you will see in your practice. So bear with me, and I promise you I'll try to keep it short and brief. So this is an update on pediatric fatty liver disease, and since some of my colleagues have taken the liberty of presenting pediatric cases to you about autoimmune liver diseases, and I just wanted to make a caveat that the only reason why we use drugs in pediatrics without randomized controlled trials is that we can't find any companies that are willing to support the research to do it. And luckily, for some of these things, like our NASH network, this is funded by the NIH, and that's why I'm so willing to be part of it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about pathogenesis, and I'm not going to try to bore you with that. Guidelines for diagnosis and evidence-based recommendations on treatment. So definition, I'm sure you're all aware that you know, the umbrella term is non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and this hepatic steatosis, and this is usually seen by imaging, usually in ultrasound or on histology biopsy. And clearly it's a diagnosis of exclusion, includes entire disease spectrum, without hepatocyte injury, without fibrosis, to the NASH, where there's both steatosis, inflammation, ballooning, there is with or without fibrosis, and obviously NASH can progress to cirrhosis. Typical histology of NASH, the fat droplets and fibrosis, and that I'm sure you're all aware that there's a progression. And this slide, which is from Medscape, I should tell you that the arrows are pointing only in one direction, but I will remind you that we now have pretty good evidence to show that with treatments that this is actually reversible, and you can get the arrows going from NASH and fibrosis back to NAFLD and even back towards normal. I'm sure you're aware, you know, you always hear the term that children are not little adults, and adults are not little children. And I want to remind you that there are two types of NAFLD. And one of the big issues within our network is to try to decide at what point does pediatric NASH become adult NASH? Because in type 2 NAFLD or type 2 NASH, what happens here is that it's mostly portal inflammation and fibrosis. And there is no ballooning, there's no Mallory bodies, and it's zone 1 steatosis. Whereas in the adult type of NASH, which you are probably most familiar with, there's zone 3 steatosis, there's ballooning, and it's perisinusoidal fibrosis. So if a patient is an adolescent and becomes 18 years old and is able to vote, and is now considered an adult, does that mean that their NASH on their 18th birthday converts from pediatric to adult NASH? It's an unknown issue. Pathogenesis, not to belabor the point, but when we first started doing all of this, there was this two-hit hypothesis, where the first hit caused, you know, steatosis, and then there were environmental toxicants, a reactive oxygen species, and that whether or not you got ash or NASH, that was what was felt. And then Dear Tony came up with the lipotoxicity hypothesis, where, you know, it's really the hepatocyte-free fatty acid flux that gives rise to reactive oxygen species, and this leads on to NASH. So is this really a problem in kids? And the answer is, you know, that there's an obesity epidemic, that 30% of the population is obese in the United States. And in fact, it's the most common pediatric chronic liver disease in North America. 2 to 9% of all U.S. adolescents have NAFLD. 20% of U.S. obese adolescents. The rates in younger children are unknown, but they're definitely increasing. And the natural history is not well understood, and that's one of the opportunities within our NASH Clinical Research Network is to actually study this. We know that in adults, NASH is associated with increased overall mortality risk, and it's the leading cause of death is the cardiovascular disease associated with this, and there's increased liver mortality, and that there's increased hepatocellular carcinoma as a result of this. In children, we really don't have a lot of natural history studies. There was one retrospective single-center study of 66 children. 5 had serial biopsies, and 4 had fibrosis progression. If you don't take anything home from this talk, I think the thing to remember is that there are NAFLD guidelines that were published in Hepatology, which was really amazing because they were practice guidelines by the ASLD, the ACG, and the AGA. And to be able to get all 3 of those societies to actually agree upon something, at least in my career, has been unusual. And there's also, within pediatrics, there is the ESPGHAN guidelines from our friends in Europe. The reason why I don't think there's NASPGHAN or pediatric GI guidelines is because some of the folks that are pediatrics from our group in NASH, CRN, actually were involved in the ASLD guideline. And I'm sure that you're aware that the grading system that's used for these guidelines is either strong or weak, and then the quality of the evidence, they give grades from A through C. If it's, you know, really good evidence, then it's an A, and obviously if there's a lot that needs to be done, it's given a C. So guidelines for screening, these are from the American Academy of Pediatrics, which is sort of what most pediatricians use as the Bible as to what they should do. It's recommended that we don't start screening until 10 years of age, and then that be done every 2 years. But I can tell you that we certainly see children long before they're 10 years of age that have NAFLD. The other issue that I'm sure you're aware of is this AST-ALT issue, and that as the population has gotten more obese, that AST and ALT in the reference numbers for the laboratory have increased, so that, you know, 40 and 60 for the upper limits of normal for your transaminases are not really true numbers. In fact, in the AAP guidelines, it's very careful that we call patients not necessarily obese, but overweight. And in fact, pediatricians have actually been sued for using the term obese to describe their patient. So I will just caution you, if you have some of your patients that are very sensitive to their weight, you might want to use the word overweight. But a BMI greater than the 85th percentile for age, for gender, with risk factors, or a BMI greater than the 95th percentile, regardless of risk factors, should get screened for transaminases. Because I think you may or may not be aware that most kids don't get blood work. What are the risk factors? Clearly, family history of obesity-related diseases, hypertension, early cardiovascular deaths, or strokes. Patient history of elevated blood pressures, hyperlipidemia, tobacco use, typical, same as in adults. It's not recommended in adult primary care clinics or high-risk specialty clinics that patients be screened for NAFLD. That's a 1B recommendation here. And it's not recommended in overweight or obese children, mainly because of a paucity of evidence of what you're going to do once you find it. And it's also not recommended for family members of people who have NAFLD or NASH. But again, I would caution you that it's very likely that they do, since 18% of NASH patients have a first-degree relative that have NASH. And here's from Brent Tetry, what are normal LFTs? And you can see how the bars have moved up, but that, you know, it's recommended that, you know, women have probably upper limit for women on this was 31 and for men 35. And I think it's even lower now, right? I think it's like 25 and 19. So what are normal LFTs? There was a study known as SAFETY, which was screening ALT for elevation in today's youth. Very catchy term. If you look at U.S. Children's Hospitals, ALT upper limits of normal, median, and the range was for all children 53 with a range of 30 to 90, for boys 50 with 30 to 70, and for girls 40, 29 to 65. And then if you look at the NHANES data, for 12 to 7-year-olds without liver disease, you can see 95th percentile ALT was for boys 25.8 and for girls 22.1. So clearly, if you're using 40 as your upper limit of normal, that's probably almost 1.5 times the upper limit of normal for the true value of transaminases. Demographics, males greater than females. Are estrogens protective? That's another question that people are looking at. Hispanics have the highest risk. Asians are also at risk, but African Americans appear to be protected. And certainly there's family history of obesity, insulin resistance, diabetes, and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Has the diagnosis? Transaminases don't correlate with the presence or severity of NASH. You need to make sure you're taking a history about medications, family history, and in adolescents especially, alcohol screen, because, you know, do they have ASH or do they have NASH? And again, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go through all these labs, but you want to obviously, it's a diagnosis of exclusion, so you have to make sure that they don't have something else. It's like Wilson's disease. Common causes of secondary hepatic steatosis, you know, you need to see if it's macrovesicular or microvesicular. I'm sure you remember that, you know, microvesicular fat is associated with rise or medications or inborn errors like LCHAD, which in the pediatric population you would see at a pretty young age. There's a lot of talk about cholesterol storage disease and Wolman's disease, and in fact there's a drug company that's pushing real hard to have patients screened that have NASH for these inborn errors in metabolism. I can tell you that I think the likelihood of you finding somebody with an inborn error in metabolism in your practice is slim to none. When do you pursue a workup for metabolic or genetic conditions? This was addressed by the SBGAN guidelines. Obviously, if you have somebody who's young, in fact, if they're less than 3, you better be thinking about the fact that they might have something hereditary. If they're non-overweight or obese and they have fat in the liver, you need to start thinking about metabolic things. Or if they have other things like developmental delay or severe hepatosplenomegaly, then clearly metabolic disorders might arise. But I think the likelihood of somebody making to adulthood and not being picked up with these kind of problems is pretty unusual. Evaluation of incidental steatosis, history and clinical exam, obviously. And if they have suspected NAFLD, they clearly need a workup. But there's no biopsy recommendations. So when do biopsy adults for NAFLD? You know, there's a lot of data now coming on with the use of using sound waves and looking at stiffness of the liver. There are studies now being done as far as NAFLD goes, but I would caution you that while stiffness is a good measure, perhaps, and looking at fibrosis in the liver, it won't tell you anything about inflammation, nor will it tell you anything about how much fat is in the liver. So those tests, in my mind, still need a lot to be developed. And the best method to look at fat in the liver non-invasively is actually MR. Problem is that's rather expensive. So I don't think you're going to be doing screening MRs. So when do we biopsy children for NAFLD? There's a lot of waffling, is what I would say, between the ASLD and the ESPGHAN guidelines. Because it's basically when the diagnosis is unclear, that's what they're recommending. And if you're going to put them on medications that potentially could be hepatotoxic, they probably should get biopsied. And I wouldn't disagree with that because you want to know baseline what they have. But there really is no consensus. So how about autoimmune markers? We heard a little bit about autoimmune markers earlier as far as autoimmune disease, but you should remember that 21% of NAFLD patients had ANAs greater than 1 to 160 or an ASMA greater than 1 to 40, and it was not associated with histology, and those patients did not have autoimmune hepatitis. So we see often autoimmune markers in patients that have NAFLD. But obviously, high autoantibody titers with higher AST to ALT and an elevated IgG, you have to be thinking about, do they have autoimmune hepatitis, as Marion had mentioned earlier today. How do we manage these patients? So here's an algorithm, which I'm not going to go through all this stuff, but obviously, if you suspect they have NAFLD, and if you're thinking about you're going to treat them, then clearly you should consider doing a liver biopsy in the year 2013. What's the treatment? So everybody knows about lifestyle modifications to treat NAFLD, and I can tell you from a lot of experience in my clinic, patients mean well, they talk the talk, they walk the walk, and they don't really do it. Because the amount of weight loss that's required through lifestyle modification is quite a bit. And in fact, if you can get patients to lose 10% of their weight, they usually will normalize their transaminases. At least that's usually what I see in adolescents. The problem is that to get them to lose 10% of their weight when they weigh 200 pounds to lose 20 pounds is quite a feat for most adolescents in the year 2013. But if you get 3 to 5% weight loss, you probably will reduce hepatic steatosis, and if you get 10%, you'll reduce the necroinflammation. And you can actually improve their activity score on the biopsy. And there are poster children, and I definitely have a couple in my own practice, but the majority of them, they won't do it. And you know, it's more of a societal issue because, you know, schools no longer have daily gym. And, you know, all the activities where kids would have the opportunity to exercise have basically gone away. And I'm not saying that's the right thing, but it's clearly one of the reasons why I think we're having this epidemic. So how about treatment for pediatric NAFLD and NASH? So lifestyle modifications is still the best thing. Diet and exercise will work, but to get patients to actually do it is tough. So vitamin E was one of the things that we used in our tonic trial, which was the treatment of NASH in children, which was from the NASH CRN. And in that our study, which was published in JAMA, it was a randomized controlled trial of vitamin E versus metformin versus placebo for 96 weeks. And one of the things I should tell you is that was really a first for pediatrics was that we were able to do liver biopsies before treatment and following treatment. Because in the majority of the time, to get two biopsies in a child is asking a whole lot. But we were able to do that for this study. And the bottom line was there was no difference between groups in sustained ALT reduction. Vitamin E significantly decreased the NAS activity scores and improved NAS resolution. It was 25% in the vitamin E group versus 11% in the placebo. Now, you can't just use any old vitamin E. You need to use really natural vitamin E, and it's 800 international units of the RRR form of alpha-tocopherol. If you go to your GNC store, you're probably not going to get the RRR form of vitamin E off the shelf. Now, there's obviously some concerns about vitamin E because in the Pivens trial, again, it was shown to be helpful, but there's all this conflicting data about heart disease and problems with vitamin E. So if you're going to do it, you're going to have to be pretty careful in who you give it to. Vitamin E clearly did not improve fibrosis in the Pivens trial, which was the adult trial. It improved steatosis and inflammation and ballooning, and NASH improved. If you look at all-cause mortality, though, the meta-analysis data is not so clean. And there's also an increased prostatic cancer risk with the high doses of vitamin E. So just keep that in mind in the adults. One of the things which our pediatric endocrinologists have been really keen about using has been the use of metformin. And I can clearly state with very good evidence that metformin is not the treatment of NASH. It did not improve it at all. In the adult trial, pioglitazone was recommended in biopsy-proven non-diabetic adults, but the problem with the glitazones, as I'm sure you're aware, is you can improve the NASH, but the patients gain weight. So I'm not sure that that's really the best drug long-term for treating these patients. Urso doesn't work. Omega-3 fatty acids, there's a lot of debate right now about whether or not this does anything. There's large multi-center studies ongoing. The verdict is not out, but I don't think it's so simple just by what fat you eat as to whether or not. And statins are not a specific treatment for NAFLD or NASH, but they certainly will treat patients that have dyslipidemia. Bariatric surgery. NAFLD and NASH are not a contraindication, but there's been no randomized controlled trial evaluating bariatric surgery as a treatment for NASH. In two meta-analyses, bariatric surgery improved steatosis, steatohepatitis, and fibrosis, but the Cochrane reviews, because the data is really small, is that they weren't able to show that there's definitive benefit. And in cirrhosis, it's clearly not established. So that takes me close to the end here, and I just wanted to mention to you that what we're using currently in the pediatric arm of our NIH DDK NASH Clinical Research Center is the use of cysteamine bitartrate, which has been called the CINCH trial. And we're currently actively recruiting, so if you have any adolescents floating around that you're interested in, I'd be happy to talk with you because I'd love to get them into this trial. But it's for children 8 to 17 years of age with proven NASH on biopsy, and it's a double-blind, placebo-controlled, phase 2B randomized controlled trial of 52 weeks of treatment, 24 weeks post-treatment follow-up, 6 follow-up visits, and a post-treatment liver biopsy. So they have to have a pre-treatment biopsy as part of the standard of care, and then they get enrolled, and then they get a follow-up biopsy. And we're enrolling about 160 children. There's 10 clinical sites, and we're one of those sites. And the primary outcome is improved NAS scoring with no worsening of fibrosis. And again, going back to the hypothesis here, you know, reactive oxygen species is really what's probably part of what causes NASH. And what cysteamine bitartrate does, it's a limiting factor in glutathione synthesis. And you know, glutathione, if you remember your acetaminophen liver toxicity, that, you know, an acetylcysteine is replenishing glutathione, and the whole idea here is cysteamine bitartrate. Now, cysteamine bitartrate's been around for quite a while. It's used in children that have a rare metabolic disease, cystinosis. I'm sure you don't have any of those in your practice, but the drug is relatively safe to use. It's twice daily dosing. It's enteric coated because there are side effects of cysteamine bitartrate. And based on the pilot study, it seemed to have worked. And just to remind you that NASH is increasing as a cause of liver transplantation, since this is a transplant symposium. And that is it. So thanks for your attention.
Thanks so much, Phil.
So what's the youngest age you've seen cirrhosis from NASH?
I think the reports are like 5 or 6 years of age. I mean, we've transplanted somebody who is 15 years old because of NASH.
This is amazing.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.